Welcome to Two Men in the Middle, Democracy in Flyover Country. From here, we'll discuss today's topics from a Midwestern perspective, with our boots firmly on the ground in the red state. I am Mike McCammon.
I am Craig Hewing.
This week's topics, immigration, and I'm going to get this right,
Overton
window. So we're going to all learn from Professor Huey what that is, and talk
you
about
said
that.
You said you knew
well,
this
I heard about
too.
It, but I'm not, I mean, you know, I'm getting a little subconscious about doing this podcast, because Now that I'm running for office, I'm concerned that there's some researcher listening to every single word.
Oh.
And if I'm not like 100% researched on a topic, they'll say, you don't know what you're talking about. I'm like, hey man, you know, like my podcast buddy shows up, says, I'm going to talk about this. And I got to find
some obscure principle, and here we
yeah,
go.
Let me make sure I can Google it before I actually open my mouth.
Isn't that one of the problems that we have, though, is in absence of actually having a debate or a conversation about a topic that you may not be 100% stump speech rehearsed on,
right?
That in the absence of that being acceptable, people just say the same thing over and over and
well,
over again.
Yes, that does happen. And there's always the kind of like the answer divert, you know, that kind of, you know, well, that's a really important issue, but I also think this is important. Like you just kind of just go right to complete someplace else. But the thing
we now call that the Kellyanne Conway, who's brought that to,
or the yes, but
level.
Or
now.
What aboutism and all that
now.
Stuff. No, I think that, what I'm finding, well, this process of, electing someone to office is kind of, it's flawed in lots of ways. Now, by the way, if I win, I'll talk about how I'll glow as to how worthwhile the process is. But at this point, you know, it's like I was thinking about the other day, like, you go to these candidate forums, or the Kansas City Star is doing these live things online on Facebook, and all these venues are you know, they're very artificial.
Yeah.
It's like, okay, I'm going to try to stump you with a question and make you look like a, you know, like you don't know what you're talking about. And then if I'm the viewer of that, you say, oh, well, that person doesn't know the issues very well. And that really is only a measure of your ability to memorize talking points for the most likely questions and be able to anticipate which questions you might get. Now, that's all. You need to be prepared for that. I'm not saying you don't need to be.
Yeah.
But, like, the ability to, like, think on your feet and come up with an intelligible answer, I'm not sure that's, like the number one on the list of things you should have, you know, like, to be in an elected office. I mean, you need to be a good person. Like, there's no good question for that. I think you need to care about other people. Like, no, there's no question about that. It's like, you know, well, what do you think about the H-1B visa program when it relates to this people that live in that town that have this job? I'm like, well, I'd have to go research that. I mean, that's the only real answer you can give for that.
See, but I heard that question totally different. How I would internalize that question is, you're asking me about what I think about immigration and letting people in the country and my overall.
Well, you have to be careful.
Kind of
you have to be careful because, you know, sometimes they do want that very specific question. And by the way, that happens a lot with pro-life, pro-choice. They'll be like, well, what in the case? What about?
How can pro-life, pro-choice be that granular? Isn't it?
Well, because I can't remember. Some state just passed, or someone just outlawed.
Iowa just did
the six-week thing. Well, how many weeks is it then? You know, and it's like, you know, you really want to, like, you want to be Houdini on that one. You want to get out of that one. And it's not that I don't have a position, and maybe I don't, but it's like, man, that's a really specific question. It feels to me like I should go spend some time talking to people to find out what the answer is, as opposed to just firing something off. And
is
like,
that ever an acceptable answer to somebody? Ma'am, I have a base understanding of what you're asking, but if you really want me to, give me some time and I'll get back to you.
I think that that's acceptable in some venues and unacceptable in others.
Yeah.
I also think that if, like, you're in a candidate forum venue, if all the other people have well researched the answers, then you look bad because it looks like you don't know. And I have been, in fact, I just had a meeting earlier this week about immigration, as a matter of fact, where I had one person that was pretty unsatisfied with my position on some things. And I told her many times, and she was very willing to do it. I said, you know what? I want to come down and meet you and some of the people you know that are affected by this, because I feel like I need to know more.
Yeah.
I said, I think my position, if the fact that you don't think my position is right, I just think you need to help me understand where I'm wrong. And that is something that people do find endearing, I believe.
Absolutely.
And it's genuine too. It's not like some gimmick I've got that there's like some magical thing I've come up with.
So what was the situation in immigration that was affecting her personally?
Well, it's because of her life journey. So, you know, here's the problem you have with immigration, not to jump right in today, but you know,
we're on a short clock. Remember,
we are on a short clock. So all listeners, I'm going to be warning. I have a meeting this morning. So before Craig even thought about coming to my house, I told him, like, I'm going to have a short.
We had a hard stop.
We have a hard stop for a change. no, the place where that went, if you stand back, you know, there's one place you can go and say, okay, our immigration policy should be fairly loose and we should let everybody in. And then there's this other place that there is a constituency of voters, particularly in the district I'm running in, and I think actually this is true across the country, that say, you know, there is the rule of law, you know, and eventually we're going to have to enforce some of this too. Like we can't just not enforce it.
Canada, Mexico, and America are not merging into one giant territory.
Or any country south of the border or north of the border or the Norwegians or any of those people coming in. Like, we're not. So, now, there was a time over a century ago where we did have open borders, and that was the case. I mean, we basically let anybody in. But for a variety of reasons, the country's decided we're not going to do that anymore.
Yeah.
And so, you know, when I kind of started the conversation with him is I felt that our immigration laws should be welcoming, fair, and just. We need to let people into the country. They need to be fair, but we also need to enforce them too. I mean, we can't just like go willy-nilly on it. And so I think that particular part of the conversation was just around, that person's particular issue was with my position on what we call chain migration, or I guess I would call it, I guess the president calls chain migration.
Yeah, it's family migration.
Family migration. Yeah. So what my position that I told them, and I said, you know, I'd be more than willing to hear any conversations about changing it. My position was that we should support immigration for what I'm calling the nuclear family. So if someone comes over, they can get their spouse, their children, and their parents.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the issue we have today is it also includes siblings, so your brothers and sisters.
And our policy on family or chain migration is more liberal than Canada, just to give you some perspective.
Because
Canada is what you just said.
It's that nuclear family.
Correct.
So, and what I said is, you know, because what I've been hearing is from folks that I know that actually work in INS is that there's quite a bit of fraud in the sibling thing. Not in the parent thing, but in terms of siblings.
I can see that.
And from some countries, not from all countries. And so what the position I'm beginning to kind of formulate in my mind is that, you know, what we need to do is kind of handle every country a little bit differently that says, hey, if your country, if we begin to see that there's fraud, we're going to shut the whole thing down. If we begin to see that country X is having fraud as it relates mm-hmm. to siblings, we're going to shut siblings down, all of them, from that one country. Does that make sense?
It does. Then you go country by country basis.
Now, if your country is like, if there's no fraud and everything's cool, you know, thumbs up, we're still in on that. And this is true of a couple other cases too. Well, I'm going to go way off topic. But one thing that I learned, which I did not know, is this reciprocity.
Reciprocity.
So there's 12 countries on the list. China's one of them, by the way. Vietnam as well. And Cambodia. I saw those because they're Southeast Asia, which I'm curious and interested in that part of the world. If we get someone from one of these 12 countries, those three I just mentioned included, they commit a violent crime. We want to send them home. China won't take them back.
Okay, send them to Taiwan, send them to Mexico, send them to England.
No one else would take them. But here's the idea. And the policy would be, okay, if you're not going to take anyone back, then we're going to close the valve. We're not going to take anybody. Unless you take back people that commit violent crimes in our country, we're not going to let anybody from your country in going forward. So again, the idea is not to have some Orwellian policy that like shuts out the good. It's just to say, okay, of the people that are not willing to cooperate and make this fair, then we're going to say, you know what? We're going to turn this off on you. And now what's going to happen is back in China or wherever else that might be. Oh, let me finish the thought. So now in China, if there's people that says, hey, man, we want to immigrate to the United States, they'll be like, well, no, your government won't let you come because like you're not willing. So the idea is to put the pressure on the place
where
they can change the policy. And then we can solve the problem of getting the people out of here that are criminals. And at the same time, allow people to come into the country that don't want to immigrate for all the right reasons.
So if you're in the United States on a visa, you commit a crime and you're from China, and China won't accept you back, I completely agree. We should re-examine even letting you in here in the first place if your country of origin is not going to work with us if you commit a crime. That's very reasonable.
Right. And the idea is it would be country-by-country basis. It would be based upon the reciprocity of that particular rule. But anyway, so that was the long conversation we had, is that the woman's view that I met with, and I'm going to go meet with her. I just haven't reached back out to her since our meeting earlier this week. You know, because she's in a family of dreamers. So, there's kind of a demarc line of where kids were born. There's, you know, it's complicated, you know. And I, by the way, we started that whole conversation with, I think there should be complete amnesty for the dreamers. Let's just start there. I mean, I tell folks, when you're 7 years old, you don't get to tell your folks where to drive you.
Absolutely.
So, like, you know, that's an instant. I don't know why we just don't even just do that to start with.
Yeah.
But anyway, so it's pretty big hairball. But what I keep going back to is this idea that it needs to be welcoming, fair, and just. A couple other things. Sorry, I'm just kind of – why did I take over the mic here? Didn't mean to do that. A couple of other things I learned that was really interesting is that there's only one court system. So, for instance, if you have like a paperwork violation or you miss an appointment or something, the caseload goes into the immigration courts, which, by the way, also includes hardened criminals that are and the caseload, there's like 700,000 cases in front of that, and they just can't get anything done. And so what happens is if someone has a paperwork violation, these are the stories we're hearing all the time now, they have a paperwork violation and a traffic ticket, they get picked up, and then it's like, okay, we put you in jail awaiting deportation because they can't get around to get around to actually processing your case. All the while, that a lot of times those may be people that are the single income earner of the family, and they're sitting in jail,
causing a lot of problems.
Exactly. And it's just like, and then the last thing that you know that I think everyone agrees on is we just pretty much, I've been calling it the Reign of Terror, which is pretty awful because that was like the French Revolution, and that was obviously worse in some ways because they were killing people. But you know, this idea that, you know, ICE is basically I was thinking about the other day, it's like a homebrew militia. We're just going to go hang out at the 7-Eleven, and we're going to pick up any brownie, you know, and basically process their paperwork. I mean, it's not, and when I say brownie, I'm talking about as if they are talking. That's not me, of course.
Yes.
But it's like, what the hell is that? You know, it's like, what country do we live in where people feel emblazoned to actually do that? And it's like, what? And I won't drop the F-bomb today, but like, what the F? You know, it's like, it's a reign of terror, and it's designed to completely destabilize and freak people out that live in those neighborhoods and those communities, and it's morally wrong. You know, go after the hardened criminals, go after the hard cases, and find those people and get them processed and out of the country. Don't just hang around 7-Eleven and pick people up because they don't have paperwork.
Do you think when the guy at the top, you know, patient zero in this problem, calls immigrants animals and refers to the butchery that's happening.
Yeah, if you didn't see that
yesterday.
Yeah, if you didn't see that, that was the topic yesterday.
That's our president, who attends some sort of sanctuary city meeting in California in a rambling kind of off-the-cuff speech. He refers to immigrants as animals. He refers to the butchery that's happening in California. With Trump's speech yesterday, I think this happened yesterday, you would think there are roving bands of illegal Mexican immigrants all over California who just walk around killing people with machetes and hammers.
And let me bring it home to the third, you know, here in this red state, in the middle, my own congressperson yesterday.
Mr. Yoder yesterday,
in his press release announcing that he's been appointed to the Appropriations Subcommittee of Homeland Security, his quote was, "In my years in Congress, I've traveled to our southern border and have seen the work that must be done. We must keep drugs and criminals out of our country to ensure that every family in every corner of America feels safe when they lay their head down at night to sleep."
Because there's some roving gang of
Mexican because we have basically drug traffickers and criminals just like coming in mass across the southern border. And like, to me, the thing that pissed me off about this so much is it plays on all those same stereotypes, and it's fear mongering. It's basically saying, like, if we don't build a wall, like, we can't sleep at night. And that is total bullshit.
So to me, the immigration problem is,
and racist, by the way.
The immigration problem is the problem of American politics in a nutshell. Before we went on, I talked about to prepare myself more for the podcast, I've watched like 6 seasons of The West Wing on Netflix.
Well, you're actually qualified to be president now, aren't you?
I so want to be chief of staff. That job looks so cool. What I love about this, in season 6 or 7, so this is roughly 2005, 2006, they have this great episode where the whole episode is an hour-long debate between two presidential candidates. One of the main topics is immigration. My point being, immigration is one of those topics that I can remember from first becoming political aware, the needle hasn't moved one iota. It was a problem 30 years ago. It's a problem 20 years ago. It's a problem today.
So what is the problem? What's the core, in your view, Craig, what is the core problem?
The core problem is the issue is too complex for the American people and what is, in this state, the American government to solve.
Here's
we're never going to find that 80% that you're looking for
issue. I bet we can. Here's what I'm finding. Here's what I'm finding, just so you know. So, you know, we all remember President Trump's comment about healthcare, like, who would have known that this was so complicated?
Yeah.
All right.
Everybody.
So, as I've been doing my hashtag around the third and visiting basically all these different leaders from, you know, churches to schools to police departments to city hall, like, on and on and on. What I'm finding is that in every one of the INS, and I find in all those places, there are people that work there that I meet with that are like the leaders. Like I go meet the chief of police. So this person has been a police officer for 25 years. I mean, they're a career police guy, right? Or gal. Same goes to city hall. Government people, pastors, people who work in healthcare, yeah. People who work in engineering. All these people, that's what they've been doing for 25 years. And every one of those meetings, that Donald Trump thing like plays back in my mind. Who would have thought that police work was so complicated? Who would have thought? And it's like, people do they spend their whole careers in these industries, and even they struggle with finding the right answer because it's not, these things are not simple. So if you helicopter in and say, oh, hey, we're just going to fix all this, you just can't because, I mean, you can, but you got to really sit down and talk to a lot of people to figure out where the right places to push on.
The statute of limitations on this is hard, so we can't fix it has run out. I don't buy that anymore. And we're past where that kind of excuse puts us.
I'm
the only person in the past 30 years, I think, that took a significant swipe at immigration was Barack Obama. And he had to do it through executive order.
Right.
And I disagree with him starting DACA through executive order. I agree with DACA. But executive order was not the way to get that done because there's no permanency to it.
Yes.
And now we're 17 months into the Trump presidency. The legislation.
Has it been that long?
I think so. 17 or 18 months. We're almost halfway through this. There's been no legislative fix. The Congress and the Senate has shown no desire to do anything.
Well, they need to do something.
And now we're bogged down in the court system. So we talk about this all the time. This is a 30% topic on this podcast that we dedicate time to immigration. Nothing is going to happen. Because again, you've got one guy playing into the fear to the law and order. This is Trump and his crowd, who now has made it acceptable to refer to people as animals.
Right.
Paint them as people that are murderous, non-law-abiding, completely devoid of fact. That's the thing that really aggravates me. Facts gone in this conversation. When's the last time you saw an honest, fact-based discussion on immigration?
Well, I've had some this week, but I know what you're talking about.
You can't find it. Once that happens, all this is my fear is we're just going to run the same treadmill we've been on this topic.
And here's some
things, because nobody wants to solve it.
Yeah, and here's some things I'll also add real quick as we kind of leave this topic and move on. I've been meeting a lot of people that are naturalized citizens. You know, so not first generation Americans, but I'm actually first generation Americans as well, but a lot of naturalized citizens. And I have to tell you that I would go so far as to say that they are. I don't want to say they're more patriotic, but I would definitely say they are as patriotic.
Like measuring people's patriotism.
Well, I was just saying. I agree with you, but what I'm just saying is that I want to dispel the myth that unless you're born here, you're not a real American, because that's not true.
Would it be more fair to say they have a high level of enthusiasm for?
They have a high level of enthusiasm. Okay. They care deeply about this country.
Yeah.
They risk a lot to come here.
Yeah.
And they left their families to come here.
Absolutely.
And that's something that, you know, there's a lot of folks that live in this part of the country that that won't even leave their state, let alone that's their country.
Their county.
Their town, whatever. And it's like, okay, you know, like, celebrate what has happened. Celebrate the fact that we have a country that people want to move to. Celebrate the fact that people have moved here, want to make a contribution to our community and make the world a better place for all of us. Celebrate that. Don't sit around and talk about them being criminals and drug traffickers. It's just ridiculous.
This is why the facts are so important in this. So Jody and I took my daughter to her early college orientation yesterday. Yeah. She's going to a small liberal arts college in Iowa. They played this great video that talked about the value of a liberal arts education. And they kind of threw two stats up on the big screen in this video. Number one, India in K through 12 has more honor students than we have children in America.
Well, that's a numbers thing too.
And China is right behind them. The fact is, for America to move forward as an innovator, as entrepreneurs, to keep our economy driving through this new century and take advantage of all this new technology that's coming online, guess what, guys? We need those kids. We can't do it by ourselves. If we're going to continue to grow and evolve and be the country that we are, we've got to
become... Well, now, by the way, just I want to make sure that we go on record with this. You're not saying that the public school system in America sucks. You're just basically saying it's a numbers thing. I mean, they have 4 times more people than...
I'm saying this. If you put the American public system and the Indian public school system on a continuum...
You need to be careful with that. I'm gonna push you on this. Have you ever been to India?
You're gonna have to show me some facts then. Okay. You're gonna have to back that up with something that says.
You haven't. Here's what I would say, just to carefully tell the story, because I've visited schools in India and I've visited schools in Africa. My son teaches in schools in Africa. I'm just gonna tell you.
Well, Africa wasn't part of my conversation.
So let's throw schools that abroad. That. Schools
you pivoted abroad. From India to Africa.
Schools abroad. Okay, I'll stay focused on India. The thing that most Americans don't know, and I'm not an expert on India either. By the way, I've traveled there many times. There is very much a have and have not there. There are schools where the best, brightest kids, I'm sure, getting a great education.
Absolutely.
But there are a lot of people that live in edge of poverty there that go to schools and there's dirt on the floor.
Absolutely. And doesn't change the number. That's true. They still have more honor students than we have kids.
If they have 1.3 billion people in that country, many of them young, they're going to have a lot of kids that are honor students just by the nature of the math.
So the people that I know from India who are in tech, and you probably know the same kind of class of folks that I've been talking with, they talk about the seriousness that they took their education in what we would call high school. And that it was very much laid out for them to get to the university that you wanted to.
Oh, yeah.
You had to score in your Providence. You had to be in the X percentile before you would even be considered for some of that
stuff. And let's play math here, too. Because the country is so populated and there's so many people, the limited opportunities in universities are highly competitive. And you're drilled with that as a younger age. Whereas here, you know, there's schools all over the place.
Absolutely.
And colleges. And so... The competitiveness in high school doesn't have to necessarily be there because...
Let me restructure my argument.
Yeah.
They take it more serious than we do. They're not worried about their kid getting on the cheer team. They're not worried about how the high school football team is. Schools, and I grant you that this is a slice of them because there's a whole section of poor that this doesn't apply to. But again, let's remember the numbers we're dealing with. They take getting you into that... to score high enough on that test to get you into that 3%,
right.
Very, very seriously.
But just to make math really, really super simple, and I'm rounding all kinds of ways that don't make any sense. Again, I think it's a numbers thing, not a quality thing, personally. But if there's a billion people, just hear me out here for a second. If there's a billion people and 10%, if there's a sample size of a billion kids.
Yeah.
Now that's not accurate, but I'm just going to use it as a number. There's a billion kids. And if you take the top 10% of those billion kids, there's 100 million kids.
Yeah.
Okay. If it's the United States and there's 300 million people, you take the top 10%, there's only 30 million. It's just math. It has nothing to do with the quality of our school.
I'm not going to let that one go.
We're going to disagree.
It's a cultural thing, perhaps.
No, I don't think it's cultural either.
You don't think cultural... for the kids in India that participate in those schools, their academics, their scoring, their ranking is way more important than it is overall in the United States.
I you're really making some big stereotypes, but I understand what you're saying, and I can see that there may be some truth in it, but I don't agree, because I believe that there are a lot of parents here in America that push their kids really hard to do well in high school.
I think there's a lot of kids in America that push their kids to make the football team.
I agree. There are
a lot of kids in America who push their daughter to make the cheer team.
Absolutely.
I don't know how many.
And here's what I would say, just to kind of like, you know, this, you know, be Mr. America here. The one thing that I know happens in our public schools, and I can't say if it does or does not happen in schools abroad, is our country does try to celebrate differences and how people excel in different things. So the idea in the public school system is, hey, you know, I'm not a big fan of, well, I played football in high school. I was terrible at it. But I mean, the point is, there are some kids that are good at that. There's some kids that are good at woodworking. There's some kids good at engineering. And it's like, and I think there is a part of the American experience of public education is to celebrate every student and the things that they're good at. And so it's not like, hey, everyone, like, crack open the books, we're doing calculus today. I don't care if you can handle it or not. Craig is noticeably upset. So the good news is we don't have much time today. So let's get on to your next topic today.
I'm going to close this topic with this. Whatever we agree or disagree on, the facts, the one fact that we can't ignore is
there's more people in India.
The number fact that higher population in whatever they're doing to educate.
Yes.
We can debate that at nauseum. They are creating a huge number of educated, qualified, ready
to work,
in high tech,
absolutely,
and other important, the STEM
medical,
things that we've
medical.
Talked about. It's there. It's coming. That has to be part of our factual based immigration policy.
I agree.
If we don't tap into those types of populations, it's going to fundamentally change what America is.
The way I look at it is that if you're talented in whatever, if you're talented in whatever you can do, and you want to come to this country and can make the country better, we should probably find a way to make it, let you in.
Maybe this debate's a perfect example of why the immigration problem never gets solved. Because we talked about something that was just factual. Hey, India's got a bunch of people. They're producing a ton.
No. The place where this went sideways with me is when you started criticizing American schools.
That's what I'm saying.
Because that,
we went from, let's talk about that fact and what that's going to mean to our economy and our society moving forward in a global kind of organization. And we got sidetracked to, why isn't America number one and why is India?
No,
we went all through there.
Yeah, okay. Well, that's fair.
You don't agree with that?
I'm not saying America's number one. I'm just saying that.
I made the statement, India's better than America. You threw your hand up and said, stop, we have to debate that.
Well,
when it's irrelevant to the conversation.
And by the way, anyone that's doing research for my political campaign, I just said that the words that I should never have said. I said America is not number one.
We are number one across the board, Mike.
Come on, what are you talking about? I'll play some Neil Diamond, Coming to America. If you remember that song.
It's my wife's favorite song.
What's that?
That's my wife's favorite song.
Is it really?
She has a dance routine to it. She does.
Does she really? I remember, and it's a very strange patriotic memory of my childhood. What year would that have been? Probably 78, 77, something
when
like
Coming
that.
To America, yeah. It had to be late 70s, early 80s.
It was late 70s, I want to remember. But I was actually at a fireworks display, and they played it. And I remember just how emotional wreck I was. And I don't know why. It was like a 4th of July, you know, fireworks display or something. And what's crazy is, you know, what's crazy about that, and we'll finish up on this, is to think that was kind of a thing back then about America is a great place, people want to come here, we want to welcome. I mean, that was actually a thing, at least that's the way I want to remember it in my mind. And that, look how far we've pivoted off of that. I mean, like now today, you know, it's like, okay, immigrants are animals, we're gonna hang around the 7-Eleven, we're gonna raid churches, we're gonna raid schools and round people up. It's like, what in the hell? I mean, it really is Nazi Germany Gestapo kind of stuff. It really is.
I never make a comparison to Nazi Germany, because Nazi Germany was
It is a little extreme.
Tough comparisons to make. But this gets into what we talk about, the Overton window.
Wow, what a segment.
That was a professional segue.
In fact, it was such a great segment, I didn't even realize you were segmenting to the place.
I got to get better at signaling.
Yeah, you need to, like, I don't know, throw up your hands real quick so I know you're... Okay, next topic, Overton window. So Professor Huey, explain to all of our listeners and myself what this is.
So the Overton window was developed by a guy named Joel Overton when he worked at a Michigan think tank. I've always wanted to work at a think tank because it sounds like you just sit around and do stuff like we're doing here all day, which would be awesome.
Well, actually, not the one thing is this is a devoid of much thinking, so you may have to go someplace where they actually
anti-think.
Exactly.
So the Overton window is basically the concept that says there are only certain topics that are acceptable in kind of modern civil society discourse.
Right.
And if you step outside of one of those topics, there will be some sort of negative penalty to be paid. In the political world, these are topics that would exclude you from running for office. These are topics that end your career.
Right.
These are things that the public just basically says, we will not accept any discussion outside of this window.
Right.
And the first example that they cited was in, I think it was in 1999. There was a two-time mayor of Baltimore, Democrat, very popular, who got comfortable in his popularity. And when he was running for his third term, basically said, we need to legalize all drugs. The war on drugs is absolutely a failure. We need to legalize and treat this as a medical problem, not a criminal problem. In 1999, that was absolute heresy. And I think he ended up not even running for his third term.
Really?
The pushback on that was so severe. That's a great example of today. That's almost mainstream to say.
Yeah.
That's become part of what can be discussed in the United States from a political standpoint.
Right.
So what we've talked about is, you know, before we started this, it's how far or how closed has that window become? And as Democrats,
yeah,
we used to, I think, consider ourselves the folks that threw the window wide open.
Yeah, it's a big tent.
It's a big tent. And I think we also considered ourselves the party of intellectuals. You know, we didn't just look at base things. Cut taxes, strong military, strong borders, it's all good.
Well, you got to be careful with the intellectuals because that's kind of the birth story of this podcast. So I'm a little bit...
we're not intellectuals?
Exactly. Well, no, this was a response to the intellectuals of the Democratic Party talking down to folks in
Correct.
Red states.
But I think
and not understanding the red states.
If you look at historically through the two parties, the Democratic Party considered itself...
We've always been smarter than Republicans, of course.
The Democratic Party would consider itself, and more of its members were considered, and I'm quoting considered, because again, use whatever definition of that you like, that we were the party of more intellectual people, and we promoted more free thought.
Okay, just keep going. I'm just going to let you take that.
You don't agree with that?
I
How can you not agree with that?
I think that generally, I don't know, what is the Democratic Party? Because if you think about it, you know, is it, you know, because you've got this, the working class, you know, blue collar folks. I think a lot of them are, I slice it very differently now. I'm slicing this. Do you want to help? Are we a country that help other people, or you know, don't want to help other people? And that to me is kind of the place where you draw that line. And I think most Democrats, generally speaking, they tend to think that government can play a role in resolving some of the differences in our inequities in our country. Whereas a lot of conservative Republicans would say, you know, they're almost libertarians and say, well, like this is the fight for the fittest, and if you can't, sorry.
I guess when
is that fair? Am I distilling it down?
I guess what I'm saying is
I don't think intellectual plays in any of those two places, but it's okay. Keep going.
Okay.
For the sake of time.
Republicans have always been kind of base issues, strong military, low taxes, limited government.
Yes.
The Democratic Party has always been to your side that government plays a role in your life.
Tries to make sure there's everyone gets a level playing field.
Government can make things better.
Right.
And I think in that government can make things better, there's a role in your life, we always portrayed the Democratic Party as being more open to ideas.
Yeah, I would say, yeah.
Sure. Okay, so if we agree on that, I think it's fair to say there's mounting evidence that, especially on the Democrat side, we are shutting that window, and we are closing off that idea that you can have a bunch of diverse voices, that you can think outside
I think
of kind of the party box and be viable.
Well, and this is the thing right now that's tearing at the heart of the party.
It is
this fundamental question. Are we going to be a big tent or are we not going to be a big tent? Because we've talked about this. I mean, there are a number of litmus tests that candidates have to pass through to make them even viable. You know, the one that's not controversial today to talk about is the pro-life, pro-choice one. Like, if you try to run as a Democrat as a pro-life, it raises everyone's eyebrows.
You have a problem.
Okay. Which I would argue that, let's ask the question again, is that a big tent or a small tent? You know, I mean, so, and I'm not saying we should welcome, because I don't necessarily agree with that position, but it does point that out. Now, that's one that's not so controversial. So, tee up one that's controversial, Craig.
I think the pro-life, pro-choice one is extreme. There's nothing more controversial
than that. But in terms of, like, I think generally speaking, most Democrats are on the side of that issue. But there are maybe other things like...
Okay, I'll give you one that's just emerged in the past year. You must be completely behind the Me Too movement. There is no nuance to it. It is a binary concept.
Right, so explain to me the Me Too. So tell me what the Me Too movement is, so I understand exactly what you're talking about. Because there's a lot of pieces of that.
So I'm talking about this in context that we have finally emerged to a place socially that women are to be believed when they bring forth sexual assault accusations, and we totally agree with it. I am not arguing against that.
We totally agree that it's awful.
Absolutely. And I totally agree that the Me Too movement needed to happen, and that overall, this is a positive step that we have to take.
Absolutely.
And we have to live with kind of this pain to move forward to a better place, we normalize that, that women are free to come forward and they are believed and there are consequences to happen.
Right.
At the same time, there is no room for nuance in that Me Too movement. I'll give you an example. The actor, everything for me goes back to Netflix, Master of None. There's the Indian actor. I'm not even trying to say his name because it's this Azir. He was in Parks and Rec.
He should have been.
Which, you look at me, that means nothing.
I've heard of Parks and Rec.
His Me Too movement was very different than Harvey Weinstein's and Matt Lauer's and things of that nature. This is where a woman came out and basically said she had an uncomfortable sexual experience with him. Therefore, he is lumped into the Me Too movement.
Right.
In the Democrat Party, there is only one way to think about Me Too, and it's a non-nuanced approach. And if you came out and said, wait a minute, there's degrees to this, there's delineations, this isn't that, and this thing is not like that thing, you're going to get some pushback.
Well, and this is, you know, we're at ground zero for that because... Well, we talked about this. The Andrea Ramsey, who was in the race here,
absolutely
withdrew, and actually, she was a consequence of the Me Too movement is kind of odd, but it's exactly the thing you're describing. Yeah. There is no nuance. There's no conversation about it. It's like, okay, if this comes up, you know, and you're accused of it, then you are guilty, and
absolutely
end of conversation.
There's only one direction to go, and that is you are completely pushed out. You are completely kind of ostracized, and that is the only acceptable conclusion to a Me Too situation.
Right. I had someone, and I'm going to make sure everyone understands, the listeners, and I'm helicoptering back up for a second. But you know what I was told by someone earlier this week, which I think is a great metaphor, is you know the gates of heaven are getting narrower. You know, for you to be a good, true Democrat. You know, there are many people now that make you check a lot of boxes when it comes to, and that, by the way, is the definition of the inverse of a big tent. I mean, that's a small tent. It says, okay, and I'm just going to take some things that you hear a lot. I'm not saying I agree or disagree or whatever, or they're on the list, but there are things that are out there that people are trying to pin you down on. So pro-life, pro-choice, that's a pretty easy one.
Yeah.
The Me Too movement.
Let me give you another one. Let's say I was running for anything, dog catcher, president, whatever. And
they're about the same.
I made a statement that men and women are at their core very different. There are things that naturally men are better at and are genetically and biologically better.
Excuse me, sir.
Than women.
If this was an episode of Survivor, we would have already voted you off the island.
And that they're just they're, that. I promoted the idea that there was no. That there were differences between men and women, that we're not just both the same slate, that are completely equal. And that's not to say one is better than the other. I'm just saying they're different. You just pointed it out. Whatever I'm running for, done,
right.
out. Even though I can produce a mountain of evidence and facts.
And here's, by the way,
my
and here's the thing that the nuance here is what you just said. And I can understand why people would find it offensive and be angry about it. But see, to equate that with what Donald Trump does is like, is absurd.
I said, we're not
it's
talking
absurd.
About Trump. We're not applying
well, know,
these
saying,
rules to Trump.
Well, yeah,
we're saying in our own party, this is how we're eating our own.
Yes.
And while you just said what I said was crude and offensive or whatever, I would also, what percentage of people, though, in the Democratic Party agree with me?
What percentage of people?
I'd say at least 60%.
That there are some differences between
that, that men and women are not the identical, we are not identical creatures.
We are not identical creatures, but before the law, when it comes to our jobs and what we work and those types of things, we should be treated equally.
Absolutely.
Okay,
an argument about legally. All I'm saying is that one of the base assumptions that we can make moving forward is that we are not the same.
Well, and the thing that you should do, and we've done this with the immigration conversation and diversity when it comes to race, is that we should celebrate those differences and not hide from them.
So we're in this place to where we can't acknowledge the difference.
So therefore, we
because acknowledging the difference means we're going to rank order them,
right?
And that's the problem. You can't just say we're different, but we have different strengths, and those are equally important. As soon as you say we are not all the same, you're done.
Right.
You hit the eject button and you go.
Okay, where else do you want to go? What other minefields do you want us
Mike
to walk
through?
Mike
is just sitting there nervously waiting for me to say something that he's going to have to edit out of the podcast.
Hey, by the way, just so everyone knows, to say that we do much post-production would be somewhat of an exaggeration, by the way.
The most post-production we've done is with the sprinkler guy.
The sprinkler guy, yes. We did have to remove sprinkler guy.
So where's this, as a Democrat, my biggest fear is that the small slices of the party, because there's a lot of Democrats our age.
Yeah.
There's a lot of Democrats who aren't 24, who aren't millennials or Generation Z, who aren't Bernie folks. And when they hear stuff like this, I don't even know if that's fair to say Bernie. I don't know if Bernie really even falls into this category. But there's
a lot of folks, when
they hear that, they just get turned off.
The term... The one gate, and it kind of came through in the elections yesterday, the primaries yesterday, and I'm facing it here directly, is the term progressive. Are you progressive? Which kind of goes back to the, universal health care, $15 minimum wage, all that kind of stuff. And I generally speaking, the progressives, quote unquote, the progressives of the party are younger people. They typically are impatient. They think that like there's a simple answer to these really intractable, complicated problems.
Yeah.
And I've actually, to be honest, I've actually been calling myself a progressive moderate, which drives some people just
I know.
Insane.
There's like a few people that really have a problem with that.
Their heads almost explode.
Yeah.
They can't handle it. But I was like, I'm having a conversation with someone. They're like, well, they were asking me about, I can't remember, why do you call yourself a progressive moderate? I'm like, well, one, I'm moderate in my views. I think we should try to help other people. We need to have the courage to compromise, have conversations, all that kind of stuff. But I worked in the tech sector for 28 years. You and I have been on the ground floor of like reshaping how our world works. Okay, what other definition is there for progressive? I don't know what it is. It's this, what they've done is they've kind of co-opted that term and used it to apply to a set of policy statements that are has kind of lost its effect. But I'm kind of losing my mind here. But now I have lost my mind because I've lost my train of thought.
So there's three terms that people apply to Democrats: liberal, progressive, and leftist.
Well, I'm not. I guess I have to be progressive because leftist sounds terrible.
So
if you're
a leftist, the common definition of a leftist. Let's go.
Why don't we just throw out all these labels and ask people what do they think about the issues as opposed to trying to cobble them into one little thing?
Because if you perceive me as a progressive, a liberal, or a leftist, now you perceive my positions through that lens and it colors everything that you say or that you do. If I perceive myself as a progressive, liberal, or leftist, it shapes all of my positions.
Are you saying progressive, liberal, leftist is like all one thing? Or are you saying
no, they're three distinct things.
I'm just messing with you. Well, I'll stick with progressive modern.
Traditional liberals want to control the quality of opportunity for the largest population they can. That's a traditional definition of a liberal.
Yes, professor.
A leftist wants to control the quality of outcome. That's a very different position.
Right.
So a leftist is, we're not going to make sure that everybody has an opportunity to apply and get these jobs. Two men, three women, four African Americans, three Indian Americans, four Asian Americans have to be the outcome for this.
Okay. Yeah.
And to be honest, I have no idea what a progressive is.
Right.
I don't know what they stand for. I'm not 100% sure what makes a liberal a progressive. I don't really know.
Yeah, I think the labels are bad. So I'm trying to stay away from them as much as I can and talk about policy.
But your label is a way that you can immediately brand yourself a broad audience.
Well, and the challenge you have with the closed primary systems that we have in most states like Kansas is that, you know, the folks that vote in your primary are not the same kind of people that vote in the general election. And so, you know, I was presented with a choice that I could basically pivot. So in other words, be a little bit more left-leaning in the primary to pick up more votes from, generally speaking, the lefter side of the party to show up to vote in the primary, and then flip when you get to the general. And I said, well, that's bullshit.
Yeah. You know, that's 99.9% of candidates.
That's what I hate about politicians. So here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to say, here's who I am. I'm a moderate, you know, and I think I am a reflection of the district, generally speaking. By the way, just so everyone knows, I do have a multiracial family. I did grow up. I have a rags to riches story. I grew up a single parent family. I mean, you know, I'm not just from South Overland Park. I've had a life journey that's taken me to here, and I've worked my ass off and saved every nickel so we could basically have what we have today.
Yeah.
You know, don't come after me and say, well, you're some rich boy living in South Johnson County.
Yeah.
Like, you're like all those people we hate. I'm like, no, actually, I was able to accomplish this by working my ass off and getting lucky and having the right people to give me a job, all that kind of stuff too. So, sorry, that was, you scratched a wound there. You picked off a scab.
What wound did I hit? I'm sorry.
This whole, like, there's one particular candidate.
The label, that your label is your brand. And if you present your label, you identify your brand to your audience.
No, it's just, and I understand because people, you know, they're not running for office. They don't have to sit around and think about this all day long. But the problem we're having in our country is that people just aren't taking some time to carefully consider things and listen. You know, they basically want to see that we really are in this ADD society where it's like, okay, if you can't distill this down to like a tweet, if you can't, my judgment is actually, a tweet's kind of long. Okay, in terms of like my attention span.
Well, now that it's 240 characters.
Exactly.
You ever look at a tweet and you're like, oh my God, this is a three-parter.
Right.
Well, I have to read like 600 words.
Exactly.
Hell with that.
Well, and by the way, you know, and not to, you know, we could throw Twitter on the bus, but we had a social effort. Well, we had a social movement at the same time when we were young called MTV. And the idea was that the quick editing of videos, you know, and everyone complained about that. It's like, oh, it's been shorter attention span. And I think it does. And the thing is that no one wants to talk about immigration. They just want to know they want to know like one sentence and then they want to make a big judgment on it. And then we distill it down to one word and then it's like, okay, well, and there's no thoughtful conversation. There's no nuanced about it. There's no, hey, this is complicated. We need to figure out how this is going to work.
Yeah.
It's just like, well, come to me with a really simple solution because I'm impatient and I got 10 other things I want to go read about Kim Kardashian right now. And like, don't bother me with this too much.
It's the problem, how we digest content, and that we've all gotten to the point where if it's not in bullet points or in a tweet format, I can't pay attention to it or I can't get through it. Or has it gotten to where opinion has replaced facts?
Well, I think it's both.
I'll take five good bullet points if those bullet points are factual.
Well, I'll tell you what.
Now I get it five bullet
points.
And three of them were completely made up.
And I'll tell you what, when it comes to doing policy, it's actually relatively hard to come up with five bullet points on a topic that are well
not
thought.
If you make them up.
Well, but if they're well thought through, if they're researched, if they're validated, and they are genuinely considered positions, five bullets are hard to do.
This is what I'm saying. So from
it's really easy to just toss off a, hey, they're all animals comment like Trump did.
Absolutely.
But to actually sit down and say, okay, what is our immigration policy going to be in five bullets? That's actually, that could actually take a career to come up with the right list that's going to work.
If you're running for office or you're a politician, one is you identify yourself to a brand that people identify with.
I'm a Democrat.
I'm going common, maybe call this 101. So first, you're a Democrat, okay? Now you...
And a set of people will not talk to you.
Absolutely. So there's 46% of folks have already fallen off the planet. They're not gonna get
Well, that's not true. I've actually had a lot of Republicans talk to me, but keep going.
Secondly, now you have to define what type of Democrat you are. That's right. You describe yourself as a moderate or progressive moderate.
Yes.
So you've taken your big label. Now you come down the next label.
Yes.
Okay? So I'm a liberal Democrat. Now, third, what you have to do, since nobody knows you, if you're running for office or you're an unknown quality, next you link yourself to somebody in the Democratic Party that everybody knows. How many times have you heard over here, I'm a Jack Kemp Republican, I'm a Ronald Reagan style this or that?
And most people that are, most people that are running as Democrats in this district, well, that's not true. Some of the Democrats running for this office in this district would like to be someone like Dennis Moore, who was very much a moderate
Democrat. Yeah, I mean, Dennis Moore type Democrat.
Exactly. So,
you've linked yourself in those three ways. Now, I don't have to think so much about my five bullet points.
All fair.
Because that's hard, and half the crowd's not going to understand them anyway.
Yeah.
So if I just, now I've taken it down from five thought out bullet points that explain something. Now I just have to say those three things and give you a sound bite, and you know who I am. And I'm on to the next event where I'm going to do the exact same thing.
So jingles are good. Labels are good.
I love jingles.
Labels are good.
You have to. How can you not label yourself?
Yeah, I think that you do have to do some of this, and I am doing it. It does kind of distill the fact that campaign is also a lot of marketing, because it's basically what you do when you're trying to market a product. It's the same thing. I've got a piece of software that does this. It needs to be in this segment. It's like this. It runs like that, and it solves this problem.
You are the product.
Exactly. Congratulations. Thank you for listening to this week's podcast, and be sure to subscribe to your favorite store. Visit our website, the2minutethemiddle.com, for historical episodes and more about the podcast. Likewise, you can find us on Twitter at the2minutethemiddle for show updates and upcoming episodes. Thanks for stopping by, and have a great week.